My Auntie Greta loved rainy days. In the nursing home, where old age and arthritis had tethered her to a high-backed chair, she told us her love of rain stemmed from the early part of her life on a big, busy Fermanagh farmhouse on the shores of Loch Earn. There, she said, she loved to wake up under the eaves to the sound of rain thudding on the slate roof above her head. A wet day meant an easy, or at least an easier day, with less outdoors work. All through my childhood, I had heard Auntie Greta described as being so strong and hardworking, she could do the farm work of any man. Heaving milk churns, carting buckets of feed to calves, herding cattle. You might say Greta was lucky for having been born into a big, prosperous farm with its large two-storey slate-roofed house. She was not lucky, however, in being a big-boned, plain girl with no rush of suitors to give her a home and a life of her own. Greta's destiny, it appeared, was that of an unpaid farmhand who'd look after her parents in their old age. Her hopes had been raised when Paddy Joe, from outside Ballyshannon, just across the border here in Donegal, began a weekly courtship of her, cycling the 6 miles to her home with a bag of emerald toffees for her. PJ had already set tongues wagging by building a tiny one-roomed slate-roofed house for himself, so small that, in his own words, if anyone comes in the front, they'll have to back out as there's not room to turn around. The assumption was that he'd extend the house when he got married. A mountain of toffees were consumed over the years, but the one-roomed house grew no bigger. This sliver of a dream must have faded for Greta as she entered her 40s and an age when, as the locals put it, there was no risk of a pram in the hallway. Greta appeared to have no option but to accept her place. But what happened next took on the status of a fairy tale for me as a child. A real-life prince, in the unlikely guise of Tony, a retired guard for Buncrana, came to the rescue of my much-loved Auntie Greta. She was crossing the border to Ballyshannon on her bicycle one wet day when she got a puncture. This left her stranded in no man's land, between the northern and southern customs huts, equidistant from her home and her destination. A devoutly religious man, Tony was on his way home from his annual 3-day pilgrimage to Loch Derg when, stopping at the customs, he spotted the wet and forlorn Greta. He went to help, put her bicycle into the boot of his car and gave her a lift to Ballyshannon. Greta never told us exactly what was said on that journey, but evidently, by the time they reached Ballyshannon, what should have been an ending became instead a beginning. A barely imaginable future unfolded for both of them. As unlikely a couple as they may have seemed to others, they must have seen in each other the potential to meet their deepest longings. I still remember the flurry of disbelief mixed with some envy within the family when, in a very short time, without a by your leave, Greta was married and queen of her own castle, a neat townhouse on the main street of Buncrana, as far removed from her isolated house as could be imagined. She blossomed in this new life, delighting in having neighbours, shops, a chapel she could walk to, and most magical of all, a beach on her doorstep. I know all this from when I stayed with her on my summer holidays. Sitting together on a bench by the sea, eating 99s, I felt I would burst with happiness. Her home was to me, coming from a large, rambunctious family of seven, truly a palace. Spotless, with the jewel colours of statues and holy pictures in every room. Tony was a kind presence who would gently chide Greta when she wondered, should she let me watch Top of the Pops on the black and white TV? Let the child enjoy herself, he'd say. Greta shared 20 happy years with Tony and lived on in Buncrana until after his death. In her old age, she moved back to a nursing home in Beleek. She rests now in Buncrana beside her gentle prince. Here in Ballyshannon, whenever I walk past the ruins of Paddy Joe's tiny house, where he lived out the rest of his life alone, eating toffees, I think of Greta and Tony's tranquil happiness in that townhouse, where the sound of fat raindrops clattering on a roof were no longer needed as a refuge from life. Thank you.
A wren has taken up residence in the back garden. Small as a pocket watch, it flies through a gap in the planked fence. I get the tape measure out of the cutlery drawer, hold it to the gap, 1 inch exactly. The description of the wren in my Collins Bird Guide is more poetry than prose. Tiny round brown bird with short tail often cocked, very sprightly, flight direct and whirring. Song, loud, warbling, chirruping phrases with a long, rolling trill at the end. And the weight of a wren? 9 grams. 1/3 of an ounce of muscle, feather and hollow bone. Being so small, they chill rapidly. A harsh winter can kill 4 out of every 5, but they are resilient. Wrens are resident all year round throughout Eurasia, from the Mediterranean to the Arctic Circle, and from Iceland to Japan. One way they get through the long cold of winter nights is to nest in communal roosts, often a few dozen together. The record is 61 wrens found huddled close in a single nest box. Like many people, I have begun to pay a new kind of attention to my garden. Is it as friendly as it might be, to bird and bee, to grub and hedgehog? Is it, in its quiet way, a small step toward rewilding, a small shout of rebellion against extinction? The Organic Centre is 20 minutes from where I live in North Leitrim. They have been living the good life and fighting the good fight for 25 years now. And every time I go there, I make new discoveries. On my last trip, I learned that wrens won't visit bird tables or eat peanuts from feeders. They need a diet of insects and spiders. So one way to help them through the winter is to leave piles of stone and wood undisturbed. We had planned to tidy away the pile of cut branches and twigs at the edge of the garden, but we've changed our minds. That messy tangle may well explain our resident wren and also our resident hedgehog. I hadn't seen a hedgehog since I was a child, walking down the lane beside my grandmother's house. And then one night last summer, the dog stopped to investigate a spiny, curled ball. A rescue greyhound, she is only interested in the small and the quick. Cats, squirrels, rabbits. So, After a cursory sniff, she walked on, leaving the hedgehog to its solitary, slug-eating self. So much of rewilding is about letting things be. Let leaves lie where they fall. Let the grass go shaggy with clover and daisy before mowing. Leave the edge of the communal lawn uncut until late September. Like us, you might decide to put signs that say, "Be friendly, don't mow," around your unmowed areas to reassure your tidy neighbours that there is method in your scruffy madness, that it's your garden and not yourself that's going to seed. It's good to let things be, but the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan makes it clear that more is needed. The biodiversity also needs an active helping hand. And so we decide to make a bee hotel. I download Creating Wild Pollinator Nesting Habitat, a how-to guide published on the website pollinators.ie. There I learn that bumblebees, butterflies and moths favour unmowed areas and uncut hedgerows, and that solitary cavity bees prefer dry stone walls and bee hotels. But most bees, up to 60%, will never check into a bee hotel, no matter how welcoming or how well it's made. These are the solitary mining bees. They need bare soil to dig their nests in a, quote, open, well-drained, south-facing, sunny location. Our back garden can get sodden in winter, so that's out. There is a shady patch of bare soil under the trees at the side of the house, but that won't work either. Bees need morning warmth to get their cool blood flowing. Solitary mining bees might be happy, the guide tells me, in a sand pit, 3 centimetres deep, filled with a mixture of sand and loam. So we have a plan. We will let most of the lawn grow shaggy. We will build a bee hotel against the sunny back fence and a sand pit for mining bees in the small south-facing front garden. And so we will all move into winter. The bee larvae cocooned in sandpit and hotel, the hedgehog hibernating in the woodpile, the wrens curled up in their communal winter roost, all waiting, maybe hoping, for a new kind of spring.
I had a passion for arithmetic when I was about 5 years old, but I lost it. By the time I turned into my teens, I would shudder at the sight of a simple sum. I couldn't be counted on to numerically quantify the human experience. No one told me about the essential cosmic beauty of mathematics. Or maybe I wasn't at school that day. Or maybe I was a million miles away. I was drifting. School was a distraction from the more important stuff I had to be getting on with. I liked Latin for a couple of weeks too, but that wore off fast. We had an old record player at home, and that might have been part of the problem. As far as I was concerned, there was much more happening inside songs than there was anywhere else. If maths had been taught through song, I might have been a mathematician, but it wasn't, so I'm not. I was fond of fresh air and singing. I was worried that we were all being herded into indoor jobs where you couldn't sing when you felt like it. Some people manage very well, saving their singing for the end of the day. I wouldn't be able. Fresh air and singing suggested to me a career as a hobo blues singer. I could do that. When I was being admonished and diminished for my poor grasp of the language of the Holy Roman Empire, the knowledge that I would one day be a hobo blues singer, sleeping in barns, that's what kept me going. Then punk happened. I was 16. Suddenly everything made sense. I got expelled from school, and by the end of my 17th year, I was squatting in London. There's ambition. There was lots of young Irish in London living in squats. It's a whole aspect of the national narrative that has been hitherto neglected. Firstly, people didn't want their mothers to know, because what would the neighbours think? Secondly, when people came home and had their own kids, they didn't want to be saying, oh, when I was your age, I was squatting in London. It wasn't going to happen. Punk was about uncensored self-expression. It was about immediacy and feeling empowered. Before it became fashion, it rejected fashion. It sowed the seeds of disruption, but didn't provide any solutions. It was a start, not an end. Thrashing guitars were great. Three chords and the truth will always hold true. But the freedom to evolve meant it was bound to move on. And the squats were like a university of sorts. Young artists could afford to leave home and live in the heart of London. Books were read and poems written. Walls were painted, interiors decorated, conversations had, and music was made. Politics mostly inclined towards the dismantling of Maggie Thatcher's England, confronting the National Front, and an end to nuclear proliferation. And I was evolving as a human being. However, I had a hankering for somewhere else. That beloved place had left behind. So I came back to Ireland and became the hobo I always wanted to be. Rain and the lack of access to freight trains with boxcars meant I had to temper my dreams. But more than 40 years later, I can safely say it worked out better than I could possibly have imagined. I avoided the sort of job that scared me so much. When I want to sing the blues, I sing the blues. But I woke up this morning with a small doubt in my head. The arts have blossomed, but it has to be said there's a quagmire of bureaucracy. There's no end of form filling required, and administration ad infinitum. So here I am doing sums and struggling with an academic language of arts administration that would leave Latin in the halfpenny place. Well, all my school peers are starting to take early retirement, buying camper vans, and spending their pensions driving around singing all day. There is no punk pension plan. No punk wedding bands to supplement income. Anyway, I don't really play punk music. I've evolved. I play eccentric, gentle punk. It's a small market. A very small market. Tiny. So yes, it's a fine mess I've gotten myself into. And it's a bit late for turning now. I'll soon be 60. See what happened? One small doubt turned a hugely successful career into a dust bowl of dreams. I love my life, but nobody wants to hear songs about bumblebees and nettle soup. It's not fashionable. Those hipsters seem to have plenty of disposable income. There's millions of them splashing cash on moustache wax and beard manicures. Maybe I could start writing hipster songs about drinking beer from microbreweries and getting my Wellington boots muddy at boutique festivals. They're all very urban, though. Do you know what hipsters love more than anything? Dystopia.
The memory of landscape can be found in the peat bogs. The bog has kept precious things, butter, gold, and manuscripts. Many of us have a memory of working with turf on the bog, maybe even this summer. And in the National Museum, we can almost touch our ancestors because the bog has preserved them so gently. Bog. It holds carbon, old pieces of ourselves, is kind, keeps skin that we could touch, holds butter, good for centuries, the spirits of old trees, the imprint of all who sliced its dark, asks us to hold
a soft place that preserves, like genes, some pattern of who we are. Some of you may remember the 10th of October, 1952, the opening of the Erne hydroelectric scheme in Ballyshannon. In the construction of the scheme, Catherine's Falls were dammed. Several townlands and a number of houses were flooded. I was lucky to be given this story by Jane Swan, who told me what happened in one of those houses the day before the flood. The bees leave swans. Today, fields slip in mist, smother under a falling sky, land shape-shifting, filling, like the flooding of the Nather when they close the new dam. Each sinew of water slipped around solid land, tricked to think of rain swell. The bees fled the day before. In the walls of the house for years, honeycombed in hollow lintels. This river valley mapped in their small bodies. The bristle of each wing felt the coming of the flood, sensed the echoing silence of old rooms. Fields without birds, meadows empty, the absence of talk on the road, the way a landscape stills before storm. Then the pull of water building on each ditch, rushing the abandoned eel throws. They dreamed water spilling through the rooms, how the valley would slip its shape, the tallest trees like swollen reeds on a lake, their leaves water lilies.
The American poet Maya Angelou used to say that whenever she gave a poetry reading, she brought the spirit of everyone who had ever been kind to her on stage with her. She would say, "Come with me. I need your help. I need you now." And it gave her courage. I try to follow that advice now. I said those words just before this reading. Sometimes during a conversation with friends about poetry, I end up saying, "Did I ever tell you my Seamus Heaney story? I have a lovely memory of Seamus Heaney." The preamble to my story begins years ago, when as an adult learner, I enrolled for a foundation studies course in McGee College, Derry. I was searching for something, a kindling that could spark a glimmer. I had stayed at home when our sons were young, but they were growing up, and I needed to move forward. The foundation studies involved a range of subjects, and luckily for me, one of the subjects was English, and it included poetry. And luckily for me, the lecturer gave us some Heaney poems to look at. I had never heard of Seamus Heaney before that time. I held a trepidation when it came to poetry. I thought I needed a teacher to explain a poem to me before I could appreciate it. The first Heaney poem that was put before us was The Docker. And as I read it, something in me shifted. I understood the poem and could appreciate the wordplay in his chosen images. I felt a sense of achievement. Seamus Heaney himself, in a video discussion, is in conversation with the poet Dennis O'Driscoll. Heaney describes first reading contemporary poetry when he was in his 20s. He said it gave him an eagerness, excitement, a sense of change. A moment of writing gave him a lift, a joy, a reward. That was exactly how I felt on reading The Docker. There was a grace for me in discovering his poems. The kindling I had carried into McGee College was set alight, and I began writing poetry. My life took a whole new direction. So, we move forward in my story to years after that first learning, to an evening in West Donegal, a poetry event where I was asked to compare. I was really looking forward to that evening. I knew I would be introducing each writer and musician, but I would also be reading three of my own poems. And I knew that Seamus Heaney and Mary Heaney were in Donegal, and they would be in the audience. I felt comfortable comparing the event. The hall was full, and the audience was warm and appreciative. I was enjoying myself. I introduced several poets and musicians, and then it was my turn to perform as a poet. I said the title of my first poem, and then I thought, Seamus Heaney is listening to me. The thought began to drumbeat louder and louder within me. Seamus Heaney is listening to my poems. I started to shake, a nervous tremble that started at my toes and moved up my body. I could barely stand up. The nerves were rapidly coming close to strangling my voice. My husband and friends were sitting in the audience. I could see their expression of utter disbelief as they watched me quivering. When it came to the end of the first poem, I thought, I will not get through the next two poems unless I own my nerves. So I said into the mic, it's not easy when you are told, read a few poems, and oh, Seamus Heaney will be in the audience. There was a silence for a moment, and then, from the back of the darkened hall, a voice rang out, you're doing grand, Denise. You're doing grand. Mr. Heaney himself. I started to laugh. The audience laughed. I settled into myself and finished reading two poems nerve-free. Afterwards, at the end of the evening, I went down the hall to Mary and Seamus, and I said to them, I can always now say that Seamus Heaney heckled me. Mary laughed and she said, ach, sure, that wasn't a heckle. And then Seamus looked at me in that enriching way that he had, and he said, you could read anywhere, at any time, daughter. It was that word, daughter, that grounded when he said it, made it feel sincere and encouraging. And now, when I'm doing a reading and I feel nerves are about to invade, I hear him. You could read anywhere, at any time, daughter. And my soul settles. Thank you, Seamus. You were a gentleman.
That was part one of Sunday Miscellany Live at the Donegal Bay and Bluestacks Festival, recorded at the Abbey Arts Centre in Ballyshannon and supported by the Sandhouse Hotel Rosnaula and Donegal Arts Office. The scripts were Auntie Greta by Olive Travers, Planning Permission for a Bee Hotel by Monica Corish, Bog and the Bees Leave Swans, two poems by Winifred McNulty. Punk Pension Plan by Little John Nee. And My Seamus Heaney Story by Denise Blake. The music was These Foolish Things, arranged and played on double bass and saxophone by Connor and Michael Murray. Swallow's Tale, played on fiddle by Tara Conahan and Ellie Nicungala. The Bees Leave Swans by Hatchlings. Dystopia by Little John Nee. And The Listeners by Sarah E. Cullen.